There's one argument that
Tom Kuiper talking on 15 August 79 at Montreal. Session for search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Morrison and Schlossky in the chair.
We have to admit that we know something and go from there. Can I have the first slide? If we look at the universe then, on its largest scale, then we immediately recognize that there is a remarkable pattern of organization with increasingly higher levels of organization, and that evolution is a process by which this is important. Yes, I think I should stand on the slide. And that evolution is a process by which this organization came about. We see, and here separately, we see physical evolution, chemical evolution, physical and chemical evolution, biological evolution, and social evolution in a kind of continuous pattern. And it suggests to us that what's happened here on Earth is not a freak of nature, but a distinct process at work. The mechanisms of evolution have been studied by Prigogine and his co-workers over the last 2 decades, and they describe the organized biological and social structures, as well as many physical and chemical structures, such as lasers and convection cells, as dissipative structures. Such structures maintain or increase their internal order by dissipating order in their environment. The structures are stable, as you can look around the room at each other. But they fluctuate about a stable point. There is a great diversity about some norm. And if there is a higher level of stability, then in time one or more of these fluctuations will reach that level and stay there. Many of the transitions seem improbable, and so some are inclined to speak of singular events or even miracles. It's in the nature of this process that fluctuations far from the mean are improbable. Nevertheless, this is the mechanism by which evolution works. For evolution to proceed, it's sufficient only that the transitions are possible. And then given enough time, it will eventually happen. If there is then a suitable feedback mechanism to make the new structure stable, then a new pattern of organization is achieved. And if the structure is then also autocatalytic, if it is able to foster its own reproduction, and it competes favorably with other similar structures in the environment, then we see an exponential growth, which levels off when the carrying capacity of the environment is reached. These remarks are quite general, and they apply to microbes, animals, and social organizations. We have in recent decades become aware that we need to achieve a global stability if we are to survive. We must achieve an organization on this planet which takes into account all its various components and their proper interrelationship. Ecology, conservation, global economics, these are all but parts of this need to achieve a global organization, a fully integrated ecosystem. Once we achieve this, we recognize that there is also the opportunity of replicating this terrestrial habitat in other locations in the solar system. And the first slide is one that most of you, the next slide, is one that most of you are probably familiar with by now. I don't think that there are many who doubt that if we achieve a planetary level of integration, that's to say if we don't destroy ourselves, then eventually we will establish ourselves elsewhere in the solar system. Now eventually means not necessarily 50 years or 100 years, it could be 10,000 years. If we get back up to the previous slide, the evolutionary step that really concerns us in this discussion, though, is the transition from stellar civilization, can we raise the slide up, please, to a galactic civilization. And I think here the proper approach is not to ask in detail how we would do that, but rather to ask whether there are any known reasons why this could not be done. This afternoon there will be a discussion of the interstellar travel from a technical point of view. And I think that for now, at least, we have to conclude that, in principle, it's possible. Well, in that case, then, given a sufficiently large number of stellar civilizations, in time, at least one will be successful in colonizing another star. And once this is achieved, as we've seen in our own case, then the process will be repeated. You know, once you know that it can be done, it's so much easier to do it again. The process will be repeated until the galaxy is colonized. Now, this does not imply, as Dr. Von Herner has already pointed out, that every star is inhabited. Our own Earth, which we accept as being overcrowded, still has many isolated regions, and even human tribes that are out of contact with this long-standing civilization of ours. A number of simple calculations have been done about the time scale of galactic colonization. And just as an example, consider a travel speed of 100, the speed of light. And a period of 1,000 years for a new colony to achieve the kind of civilization that we have here on Earth. Then you can readily compute, and take one additional assumption that the typical step for colonization venture is one parsec. Then you can quickly calculate the time to colonize. And for the wave to travel 30 kiloparsecs, turns out to be 30 million years. This is a very short time compared to the age of the galaxy. And so we have to reach the conclusion that it is improbable that the galaxy is just now in its colonization phase. We could, in principle, establish that N is very small by showing that the probability of life evolving to the point of the Earth is very small, and we just saw an attempt to do that. My view of that is that these are possibilities that we can consider, but we don't, in fact, have enough information to definitively establish that fact. Biologists, as we've mentioned, have often pointed out how improbable the various stages of evolution are. But I think that the argument also ignores a curious phenomenon in nature, which suggests that it has many ways to achieve the same end result. If I could have the next slide, the one after this. This is a picture which I took out of Scientific American, in which many of you probably recognize. The species in these figures are genetically distinct, in that those in South America are marsupials, and those in North America are true mammals. And yet, in both cases, we see such morphologically distinct forms as the saber-toothed calf, a hippopotamus, and a camel. There are others there. So you wonder then whether a sentient species arose because of some unique qualities that the primates had, coupled with some fortuitous mutations, or because nature has an ecological niche for a sentient species. And we were the first one to come along and fill it. So I have to agree that N may be very small, but I haven't yet heard any compelling arguments that it must be small. And this brings us then to the famous paradox of Enrico Fermi, which asks, where are they? And this is considered the big gun in the N is small arsenal, and you've just heard the argument. One possible answer was given by John Ball, is known as the zoo hypothesis, which speaks for itself. Another possibility is indifference on the part of the galactic civilization. That would be particularly likely if the evolution of sentient species were relatively common in the galaxy. Our own planet contains nearly the full range of human evolution coexisting at the same time. And since we are being forced to stabilize our global civilization in a very short time, it's not at all clear that parts of the Earth will not remain out of contact with our global civilization for some indefinite time into the future. So we could well be one of the primitive tribes of the galaxy, not worth bothering with or perhaps carefully protected. So I think that the proposition that N is very large is not at all impossible. And in fact, it seems to me probable. The challenge which faces us is to prove this proposition by cleverly planned and executed observations. And I think that such observations would go a little further than looking around the Earth for a little green man. In summary, I think, a remarkably consistent pattern of development in the universe has been recognized now for about a century. Work in non-equilibrium thermodynamics has gone some way towards identifying the cause of this pattern, And when it's fully understood, I think that it may well lead to a revision of the second law of thermodynamics, which would state that under appropriate conditions, order increases as inevitably as it decreases under the conditions that we understand better. If such a law indeed exists, then a phenomenon like mankind must inevitably arise, and given enough occurrences, a galactic civilization will come into being. Our knowledge about the present absence of such a galactic civilization is only as good as the extent of our searches for it. Our eventual discovery that we are the first to reach the stage would be very surprising.
That's Schlossky moderating.
There were some calculations by Hart on stellar evolution following the trend of the Earth through the ice ages and so on. They show the Earth light was within a very narrow range. Instead of one IAU, it would have been 1.01, anything outside, light would not have gone.
When you wait,
I'm not an expert in those kinds of calculations. If I sense that there is an overwhelming feeling within the astronomical community that such calculations were correct, then I would have to accept that as a great impediment to life. But my impression is that the calculations themselves are still quite controversial.
I find it curious that people who argue evolution assume it stops here. You see, if you're going to argue evolution, you're on very, and you look at evolution, in fact, in terms of the number of lost species and types of creatures, you're in very good ground to assume that it's stopping here. And I recall a comment, I think, in one of George Gamow's books that the Earth and its human civilization just may represent a transitional state. So isn't there a great assumption in the kind of argument you use for evolution?
Actually, I thought that your comment was directed at other people, because I would agree with you. I don't think evolution stops here. I think we are a stage on the way, and as that one slide showed, I did not dare in this context to show evolution beyond the galactic stage, but it's discussable.
The title is as Howard, thank you very much. Intermediate thing for your view, you discussed by the end of the day.
Frank Drake, and is neither very small nor very large.
I'm here, I think, to take the middle ground. We've heard from the other.
I think we're rid of
rear. We saw from Dr. Hart that there is a great range of plausible parameters for the factors that enter into the equation which give n. And I think we recognize from that discussion that most of these cannot be established with any certainty until we have actually observed either many other planets close at hand or have detected other civilizations in space. There is a most plausible value for each of these parameters, which are derived from our admittedly very limited knowledge. For instance, our experiments on the origin of the biologically relevant molecules, our studies of the abundance of binary systems and the statistics of masses therein, and that sort of thing. If we take those most plausible values, as best we know them, all their inaccuracies, we are left to values of n which are of the order of 10,000 or 100,000 or something like that. Now, we cannot do better, as I've said, until we have actually detected other civilizations or have somehow explored in great detail other planets or planetary systems. What I'd like to do here today is simply derive as best we can from existing observational evidence some knowledge as to the possible limits on n. And I'm going to indicate, I think, that we have some information which says that n is certainly not very large, and the argument that n is very small is not supported by observation. First, with regard to the possibility that n is very large, we do have observational evidence in the form
particular, the radio searches for extraterrestrial signals, which have taken place over many years now. You'll hear more about that this afternoon. But in fact, if one reviews the data, as I guess Ben Zuckerman will, one discovers that over the years, we have searched a combination of frequencies and directions in the sky, radio frequencies and directions, which now amount up to the tens of millions. And these are with observational approaches designed to detect intelligent signals. There have, of course, been many, many observations in the course of conventional radio astronomical observations that might have detected the signal, although they were set up, of course, so as not to be most sensitive to intelligent signals. Nevertheless, there is now a large body of high-sensitivity searches which have been carried out, and none of them have produced any evidence for a signal. This, of course, suggests that N is not very large. If I could have the first slide, this point is even stronger than it may seem, or a point we should recognize, and which rarely was recognized, is that not only will there be civilizations, if there are civilizations, but they will have a luminosity function, just as all cosmic objects do. And if the luminosity function is at all plausible, the number of detectable civilizations is larger than we normally conceive of. And I've shown this to you simply to bring home that point, which is not widely recognized. Now, these are the luminosity functions shown on the same graph. The ordinary optical stars change in the logarithm of luminosity. This change the logarithm of numbers of objects per unit volume. You see the same aluminosity function for the cosmic radio. Notice they both have similar forms. The point I want to make, and it's one that's actually well known, is that the slope of these functions is always to this side of this slope line, which I've shown here, a line with a slope of -5 halves. What is the significance of that line? Well, if a luminosity function has a slope tilted to the left, if you will, with regard to that line, it means that the most brilliant objects in the sky, the most easy one to detect, are not the nearest objects, as we normally talk about with intelligent civilizations, but rather the ones that are intrinsically the most luminous. In fact, the farthest civilizations. So, of course, it is with the optical stars and the radio sources. With few exceptions, the brightest objects in the sky are not the nearby objects. They're not Barnard's star. They are, in fact, the intrinsically brightest objects. So, in our regular routine astronomical observations, we are very well aware of this situation, although we rarely recognize it. Well, it is reasonable that intelligent civilizations have a luminosity function. It is reasonable that it too has a slope to the left of this curve. In fact, that's entirely reasonable. It only takes one civilization in 300 with 10 times the luminosity of the average to obey this criteria, to fulfill this criteria. And what this says then is that in our searches, although we have concentrated on the nearest stars, we in fact should have detected the most luminous civilizations, even though they may have been on the far side of the galaxy. And we have not done that either. So the point is that the existence of a luminosity function and its probable form leads to many more civilizations, if they exist, being detectable than we normally imagine. And yet we have not detected them. And therefore, there is quite a strong argument from all of the observations that N is not enormously large. And my apologies to Dr. Quick. Now, going to the other extreme, the argument that N is small is the one that's been given by Hart and Jones and others, and it is specifically the absence of extraterrestrials on Earth. I want to take a close look at that because I think that is a very important point which has to be considered very carefully. Why have they not come to us? If I could have the first view graph, I wanted to go quickly through the picture that is used in the colonization models for the galaxy, since this is also unfamiliar to many of us. And this is probably the most simple picture. Let me describe it to you quickly. It says that a civilization starts on some planet. This could be the Earth. In time, a population N sub C grows large enough that there is a technological capability to colonize other stars. When that happens, a colonization mission, if you will, is sent out with a number of individuals, N sub naught, the initial number of individuals. These individuals travel a distance D to the nearest suitable planet, where they establish a colony, and in a given time, they evolve in their numbers, increase in their numbers to a value of N6C again, and hence this now first colony sends out additional colonies, and so the civilization spreads throughout the galaxy. I like to call this the coral model of interstellar civilization because it is an exact analog to the development of coral colonies of animals on the Earth. Now, the next slide quantifies this to give the time scale for the motion of the frontier, if you will, of such a civilization through space. If we assume exponential population growth, which is probably not a bad assumption for limited populations on suitable planets, we get the normal exponential law of population growth, and then the interval, the time, T sub C, to achieve the number necessary to launch colonies is given by this mathematical formula here, where gamma is the annual rate of increase of population, which is typically 1% for humans. There will be a transit time to move from one star to another, which I put T sub T, and that, of course, is nothing more than the distance between suitable planets divided by the velocity of the spacecraft used, whatever that may be. This means then the total time for each step in the growth of the coral is the sum of T sub C and T sub T, which is here. And that leads very simply to a formula for the velocity of the frontier of the civilization, which is equal to D divided by the sum of these two times. Notice, if the rate of population growth is zero, that is, gamma is zero, there is no colonization. In fact, that is one potential answer to the absence, apparent absence, or explanation of the apparent absence of colonization in our galaxy. Well, let's put some numbers in this. The next view graph uses some numbers of necessity drawn from our own planet, so of course they're very dangerous. But if we take, as an example, it takes something like 100 million creatures before one is ready to launch colonies. One has the technological wealth, if you will, in various respects. Then a typical colonization mission might be 1,000. Distance 3 parsecs. Imagine the velocity of the spacecraft to be a tenth the velocity of light. That does not matter too much. And if we use the typical rate of population growth of the Earth at 1% per year, then we get some interesting numbers. The time for the growth from the initial colony to a potential colonizing group is of the order of 1,000 years. Notice, because that appears with the logarithmic term, it matters very little what you pick. For instance, if the colonizing group is 100, that time only moves up to 1,300 years, hardly any change at all. For the velocity of the spacecraft chosen, the time transit is about 98 years. There's a point there. It's actually, or the time is actually controlled more by the rate at which the civilization develops than by the technology of the spacecraft used. With this particular example, we get a velocity of the frontier of the order of a thousandth of a parsec a year, which doesn't sound like much, but indeed, as has already been mentioned, it would imply that the entire galaxy would be populated in 10 million years. And as you can see, we can change the numbers very greatly, and this final number does not change much. And this is why this particular thing really must be considered very serious. Now, what are the possible flaws? Why? How can there be many civilizations and yet no colony on Earth, no visitors? I've given you one possibility. That is that zero population growth is something that is practiced necessity universally in the galaxy if we have no populations. Remember, the point is that even one does this colonization, they would be here. But I think there is a better answer, which I think may be the answer. It's the one that was, in fact, already given by Ed Anders, who has given the rest of my talk. And that is simply that it is not cost-effective. It is not economically viable to colonize. Now, let me show you how one might be led to that conclusion of necessity. This is even more an anthropomorphic argument because it is based on what happens in our own civilization. The point is simply that we do not, after all, do everything that is possible. We have gone to the moon with humans, but we're not doing that anymore. We tried it once. It turned out not to be cost-effective. We have stopped. We have built supersonic airliners, but we're not building them anymore. It turns out they're not cost-effective. And I believe so it may be with colonization. In fact, there may be colonies launched. But after the first few, they discover this is not the way to proceed, and the enterprise ceases. And why is it not the way to proceed? Well, the answer comes from asking why you colonize in the first place. The reason you colonize is to establish more living ground, if you will. Living places to give your creatures a good quality of life. And the question which will confront all civilizations is, how do you create the best quality of life for the most creatures, most economically? I think the answer is not through interstellar colonization. I would have the next view graph, and let me show you how one can make a very limited argument. We're going to make a big assumption, already mentioned, and that is interstellar colonization is beneficial and desirable only if the energy required is no more than required to give an individual a good life, however you define good, on the home planet. Some total amount of energy is required to give us a very high quality of life. This leads to a maximum spacecraft velocity for interstellar colonization, because you will not use more energy to propel your spacecraft than you could use to create a good life for an individual back home. Next view graph, of course, gives you the most very simple result. If E is the total amount of energy necessary to give an individual a good life, then the velocity of the spacecraft is given roughly from this very crude equation, and is this. Now this, of course, is a very high limit on the spacecraft velocity because it assumes that all of the energy goes into kinetic energy, that none of it is used to construct the spacecraft or to run the rocket engines or whatever is involved. So this is a very high upper limit. Now, next slide then says, ask the question, well, what about the Earth? What conclusions would we come to if we made this analysis for the Earth? And we're going to take, just to get some kind of answer here, the U.S. as an example. Because the U.S. is the most energy
oil
with the oil crisis and everything. The U.S. is the most energy consumptive country in the world. And if we take a look at the U.S., in 1974, the U.S. consumed 10 to the 17th megajoules. That's an interesting unit. And that includes oil, coal, hydro, and nuclear energy. The population was 250 million. Thus, the total energy consumption was 400 million megajoules per person per year. Now, if we assume that a typical lifetime is 100 years, we'll allow ourselves to have better health. The total energy per person, that is to give a good life, if you will, turns out to be 4 times 10 to 23 ergs. Very close to Avogadro's number. Some great significance. Well, how fast could you go? Let's have the next graph. If you assume that for each person launched into space, you have to send 10 tons. By the way, that's very little more than the weight per passenger on a large aircraft like the 747. Then, with that value of energy, the velocity is 2,000 kilometers a second. And now, here is what hurts. The time to go 10 light years, that is to make your colonization step, is 1,500 years. You do not go a tenth the speed of light, you go very much less than that. It takes 1,500 years, and that, at least to me, appears to be unacceptably long. It is not cost effective. It is much better to spend your energy back home to cover the Pacific Ocean, the floating city, or whatever, than to launch colonists into space. If you would say even that 100 years was an acceptable flight time, the energy required would be that to give 225 individuals a good life on Earth. I should emphasize again, these are very extreme lower limits. If you really take the energies required for interstellar rockets, it would be more like a million individuals worth. We'd have to take a good life for a million people in order to send one colonist to the stars. And so my conclusion at least is that biology and its time scale, the fact that we need to do things in years, the laws of physics, and the great distances which separate the stars conspire to make interstellar colonization economically undesirable. And so occasionally, a colony may be tried, but I doubt that ever a wave of colonization sweeps the galaxy. And therefore, N is not necessarily very small.
Okay.
Papagiannis.
I would like to entertain the fourth alternative. We have seen that N can be very small, N could be very large. Professor Drake just said that N can not likely is neither very large nor very small. I would like to entertain the fourth possibility that N is either very large or very small. Now, how do we reach such a conclusion? Well, when we look around, we find that life has a tendency to expand, like a gas, to occupy all available space. This one can see from the smallest entities of life, viruses, bacteria, amoebas, all the way to the higher forms of life, including man himself. The second observation is that the conquest of a new environment was achieved by life through a slow process of biological evolution, which produced new forms of life that could take advantage of the wider opportunities offered by a new environment. The most impressive example is, of course, life moving from water to land. And it had to change accordingly in order to accommodate. The third observation is that man is now achieving this transition and conquest of other environments, not through biological evolution anymore, but based on his intellect and technologies he has developed. Man can now make boats to go on water, make submarines to go underwater, make balloons and airplanes to fly in the air, and recently has also made spacecraft to conquer outer space, the largest of all possible environments. Contrary to biological evolution, which was moving very slowly and was taking millions and billions of years to achieve this transition, technology is moving very fast. And in the last 100 years, we have examples showing the unbelievable speed with which technology has developed, and also proof that the pace is accelerating continuously. I will show you briefly a few slides to make the point a little bit stronger. Can I have the slides, please? This is what the Hindus used to think about the universe, maybe 3,000 years ago. The next slide is Kepler's study, and you see the small little telescope he was using. This is about 350 years ago. Next slide is the colossal Mount Palomar telescope that we have today. Next slide is another field of astronomy called radio astronomy. And here you see Grote River with the first radio telescope that he built in the backyard in Illinois with his own money. This is something like 40 years ago. The next slide is the huge Arecibo radio telescope we have today, only 40 years ago. And to make the point even stronger, the next slide shows Grote River visiting us at Boston University, and he's still around and active in research. So in one lifetime, a new big science has developed from the little telescope he did in the backyard to the colossal ones of Arecibo. The next slide is headlines from the beginning of the space here in 1957 for the launching of Sputnik. The next one, Man on the Moon, 12 years later. And the next one, spacecraft on Mars. And the next one, exploring of Jupiter recently. This are going continuously faster pace, and only about 20 years of space exploration, and you can see what we have achieved. And the next slide, you can see that we already are talking about colonies in space in another serious manner. Let me now also make a small point with a new graph. The same thing can apply to our velocities, and also you can make it in distances traveled. Back in 1970, we would go with a velocity of about 20 miles per hour, something like 10 degrees centimeters per second. In 1970, 100 years later, we can go 1,000 times faster. And one can project maybe to go 10 in the 8 or 10 in the 9 after a few centuries. Now, the energy needed to achieve a velocity of the order of a few percent of the speed of light is reasonable if we are using nuclear fusion, and you can see a formula, and the result is that the mass needed is of the order of magnitude of the spaceship, which is much better than we do now. Finally, if we have a colonization wave, not very different from what Professor Davis said, but one light year per century, then we can cover the galaxy in about 27 years, which is only 1,000th of the time needed for colonizing the edge of the galaxy, and it's equivalent to like saying that such a colossal accomplishment is achieved in 1 week in a man's lifetime. So based on all these ideas, one would think that when a technology reaches our stage, the next step of building the way that will shoot through the galaxy is not very far away. Now here I would like to differ from Professor Jay in the sense that I don't think that we will do that only to achieve Lebensraum. Man has done many things that were not related to that, and explorers have always been around and were always willing to start something new. And we can't think that it will be a universal decision of all the colonies to decide that we need more room to send somebody out there, simply because in any rate you couldn't move very many people there. You could only move maybe 1 million of the population, and therefore this could not be a reasonable decision. However, it could be a beginning to start what seems to be natural to life, we want always to expand to conquer every available space. And now I will say two words about the formula. Can I have the next slide, please? So we are leading to the conclusion that either the entire galaxy, including our own solar system, has already been colonized for a very long time, but then of course it's the question that we had before, where are they? Or we are one of the very few, if not the only advanced technological civilization in the entire galaxy, and then the question is, what about the Drake formula that is predicting many? Let me answer the second question first. This is the typical formula that Drake has, I will not go through it, but if you, instead of trying to find out how many are currently available, you would integrate it over all time and see how many have appeared through the entire age of the galaxy, you come up with a result of 10 in the 9, something like 1 billion civilizations that have appeared. And then I would tend to agree with others that we discussed before that it's very difficult to assume that over all these 1 billion civilizations and over all cosmological ages, essentially, nobody decided to start the way just for curiosity or just because of this intense desire for life to expand everywhere. Now, what would be the answer to this? The next new graph says that it is possible that there is a term missing in the Drake formula, and I think this term is the evolution of life on Earth. Maybe life starts, and maybe ultimately it can go to intelligent life, provided we give it enough time in a hospital environment like here. It took something like 4 billion years or more for life to develop from primitive forms to intelligent life. And this 4 billion years might be a very demanding time to ask for any planet. Places like Mars, Venus, or others might have had the chance to start life, but they could not maintain this cosmical environment for 4 billion years. And if you go in details in the evolution of planets, you will find out that you will require a great deal of narrow limits to keep it going, so that greenhouse effect will not overdo it, ice, runaway glaciation, and many other problems that you could run with. So it is possible that we have neglected this term that could really reduce the whole thing to maybe only about 1,000 civilizations through the entire age of the galaxy, and probably only one at least if the survival rate is not very high. In which case, you can explain why very few, even with the very common. Now, on the other hand, it could have been that the whole galaxy has already been colonized, and then the question is, where are they? It is possible that we were going to build colonies in space. They are following the same pattern, going into different solar systems and building colonies there. The idea would be, essentially, that they would prefer to live in their space colonies rather than go on planets, because it's very, very unlikely that they would find conditions in any planet that would be suitable for them. And since they are used to making these long trips within their space colonies, most likely they would continue to live in their cosmical environments, using each solar system only as a source of raw materials and energy. And so it is conceivable that, as you will see in the next slide, they have already... I have the next slide. They have already colonized many, practically the entire galaxy, with huge space colonies that an artist has depicted here, beautifully. And they might have even colonized our own solar system. And where would they be? Probably hiding somewhere in the asteroid belt that would provide a good source of raw materials for them. Why haven't they made their presence known? That's an interesting point to discuss. My own view would be that they are watching us from there, as you will see in another good slide next. Essentially keeping an eye on us and watching us if we represent a cosmic disease that should be destroyed before it has a chance to expand, or a promising youngster in the galactic family that should be encouraged and led into the galactic family. And I think at this stage, we ourselves are not sure which of the two we represent, and you would think that the society that has probably lifetimes counted in millions of years, and probably people there have reached sort of stage of immortality, for them a short period of 100 years that represents the technological explosion for us might have been a little bit too short for them to make up their mind and act one way or the other. So this is a possible scenario. The whole galaxy has already been colonized. They are in our solar system, but they have not decided yet what to do with us, and therefore they're waiting and not making their presence known. I think, however, and I would like to close with this final thing, is that we are reaching the stage of technology that we should be able, in a rather short time, a generation or two, to know the answer to this very fundamental problem. And the final slide shows, as a representative of this idea, the little boy from Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which coincidentally, as we see, is wearing a little t-shirt saying Boston University, because supposedly his father had studied at Boston University. And I think it represents a new generation that is looking forward to the answer to this problem. And I think either answer would be mind-boggling, whether we really are the only ones in the galaxy and it is up to us to carry the flame of cosmic consciousness throughout the galaxy,